This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk about how aviation will be transformed by predictive analytics. In the news, we look at airline seat space and safety implications, why the U.S. Air Force isn't talking about a fatal plane crash, a recommendation to roll back the 1,500-hour rule, and toes in the passenger experience. We also have a report on AvGeek Day in Ecuador, observations from an Army aviator in Afghanistan, conversation about Air Force One defensive technology, the economics of pilotless airliners, aerodynamic lift, and ATC privatization. Boy, that's a lot, and it's coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 470 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. And joining me is first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Hey, David.
Hello, everyone. And hello, Max. Looking forward to a good show that I know nothing about, but I'm hoping I'm going to learn a lot.
It's all about learning a lot. That's what we live for here. And to help us with that, we also have the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Hey, Max, how are you?
Hey, I'm awesome. Hello, Max and David. Happy to be here.
All right. Well, Rob Mark, our senior editor at Flying Magazine, is off this episode. He's got a family obligation that he needs to attend to. And Brian Coleman is, as far as we know, is still traveling in his big trip. Do you guys know when Brian comes back? It must be sometime soon. Seems like he's been gone forever.
Well, we have to figure out first if he got eaten while he was over there.
In Africa.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. All right. You got to watch out for these safaris.
He's over there flapping his wings causing all these hurricanes to come across the ocean and devastate this side of the country.
Oh, it's his fault. Okay. All right. Well, our guest this episode is Andrew Kimmetmuller. He's Vice President of Aviation at Uptake. Uptake is a predictive analysis company. They forecast problems before they happen, the idea being that industrial companies can prevent costly equipment breakdowns, improve their productivity, and ensure safety and security. Andrew looks at the impact of big data and machine learning, the Internet of Things on aviation. And we're going to talk about how aviation will be transformed by predictive analysis and its ability to improve flying for everyone involved, including from the pilot to the passenger and the mechanic to the air traffic controller. Oh, Andrew was previously managing director and principal at Avintel Consulting. He was vice president of connected aircraft services at Gogo, CEO of Allegiant Systems, and he was at AirInc as a service director. So, Andrew, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Gentlemen, pleasure to be here. Appreciate the time.
This is going to be a fascinating conversation, I'm sure. Now, I really wasn't, to be honest with you, that familiar with Uptake, but Uptake has been in the press in the last few years. I see that Uptake was named Startup of the Year in 2015 by Forbes, so pretty impressive. And I understand that you guys have experienced some pretty significant growth, or at least valuation, in that time period.
Yes, we have only a three-year-old company, so we're still under the startup designation here, but it certainly doesn't feel that way in the office from day to day. We're nearing close to 900 folks here in the office. We're in Chicago, and almost all of our team is based here in Chicago. And we are almost twice what it was when I joined here about a year ago. So we've been going through some pretty high growth.
Amazing. Now, we're looking forward to our conversation with Andrew. We'll talk big data, the Internet of Things, connected aircraft, predictive analysis, all this fascinating stuff. We're excited to learn more about how it all impacts aviation. But first, let's get started with some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Our first story comes from the Daily Mail. This is, coach class seats are so tight that FAA dummies keep shattering seatback video screens with their heads during crash simulations. Well, when we talk about shrinking seat space on airlines, we usually talk about comfort, but the conversation is shifting to safety. There's a piece in the Daily Beast. It's titled, Flying Coach is So Cramped It Could Be a Death Trap. And they say, quote, no coach class seat meets the Department of Transportation's own standard for the space required to make a flight attendant seat safe in an emergency. Andrew, I'm sure you spend a lot of time flying around. Are you seeing the effects of shrinking seat pitch and seat space?
Well, you're talking to a guy who's about 6 foot two. So,
okay.
Seat space and pitch are always an important thing for me when looking at things. But certainly, yeah, we're finding as I travel, actually, it's interesting to watch as I go from airline to airline to see both how this is changing and how people are reacting to it. It seems like people are paying a lot more attention to it now than they ever did before.
I think you're right. And the Daily Mail says that in the early 2000s, the average pitch was about 35 inches. Today, it's decreased to around 31 inches, in some cases as small as 28 inches. And we've also seen, I think we mentioned this a couple of episodes ago, the activist group Flyers' Rights has gone to the courts, and a U.S. Court of Appeals said that there was, quote, a plausible life and death safety concern, unquote. And they ordered the FAA to respond to a Flyers' Rights petition asking for new rules to deal with seat space safety issues. And Maxie, we talked about the tests that airlines are required to conduct in terms of an evacuation within 90 seconds. And I think we raised some issues concerning that and whether or not those tests are really outdated and really reflect what the current reality is.
Yeah, we did talk about that recently, and I was just thinking, this is interesting because this talks about something different than the evacuation test that a lot of us are familiar with. You know, here they say the seats don't even pass the tests, and so I'm thinking, well, why are they allowed then? It's whereas the evacuation test is a required test. Sounds like this crash dummy test does not prevent airlines from using these seats. And I had to laugh when I looked at it. It said that dummies keep shattering seatback video screens. The dummies are the people that are buying the tickets. That's all I can think.
Well, that's frequently the argument or the justification maybe for shrinking seat sizes. Some people say that, you know, the consumer, the air traveler, keeps voting with their dollars and saying, yeah, I want something as inexpensive as possible. And if it's small and uncomfortable and cramped and the service is less than you might like, fine, at least it's cheap. But when we start stirring in safety aspects of this into the conversation, I think it really kind of changes the game. So
I know that I can't get out of a seat.
Well, you're also a tall guy, David, right?
Yeah, I'm 6'4" with a 38-inch inseam. So the legs have to go somewhere, and God forbid there's somebody in front of me. I mean, yes, I'll pay for the extra seat pitch, but the extra seat pitch doesn't really amount to much more than what the fact that my legs don't completely cramp up for the flight.
Yeah, and I do the same thing. I won't buy any of the United Basic Economy. It's like, no, I'm going to do Economy Plus. Yeah, it's extra money, but I just don't want to be crammed in the back next to the toilets.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was interesting in this Flyers' Right, I don't know if you call it a case, but this matter before the judge or the judges, the FAA apparently argued that decreased seat pitch had no impact on safety, on the evacuation speed of aircraft. And the judge, or one of the judges, Patricia Millett, said the FAA's claim that seat dimensions were, quote, categorically unimportant to emergency egress made no sense. So she didn't buy that. And so the FAA apparently has to respond to this petition.
Yeah, and I liked your choice of words. The seats have no impact on.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd throw that out there.
All right. Well, interestingly enough, and kind of by coincidence, Mary Kirby and I are recording a PaxX podcast later this week, and our guest is scheduled to be someone from Flyers Rights. So look for the PaxX podcast next week. I think early next week it should publish. I think that'll be episode 50. Look for that if you're interested in hearing from Flyers Rights.
In this reality show world, I suspect that we're going to start doing these evacuation tests live on television soon.
Well, that could be amusing. Sure could. All right, let's look at a military item. This comes to us from Popular Mechanics. Mysterious Air Force crash reportedly involved a foreign plane. And it seems the U.S. Air Force is refusing to identify the aircraft that was involved in a September 5th crash, a fatal crash, at the Nevada Test and Training Range. I guess there's some speculation as to what this airplane might have been. David, what can you tell us about this?
Well, David's a really Nellis dork. But first, our thoughts go out to Lieutenant Colonel Eric Schultz, who lost his life in this accident. It wasn't a good week. We had lost an Iraqi training F-16, and we had lost two A-10s. And then there was the announcement that Colonel Schultz had died in an accident, but no aircraft was given. And part of the story, what bled the story out was, the first thoughts was, by some of the junior military aircraft reporters, was it had to have been an F-35. That because they weren't announcing it, they don't want the it wasn't an F. And then eventually a general came out and said, no, it wasn't an F-35, to which that left Black Projects, which we know that the F-117 was, as well as Have Blue and some various other projects that have occurred out in Groom Lakes area have had accidents, and they've covered it up. But what most people don't realize, and yours truly pointed out to a lot of people, was that we have interesting aircraft that fly out of the Groom Lake range. There's something called the Red Hat Squadron, which is an aggressor squadron. Now, everybody knows that Nellis is where they hold Red Flag. And one of the big deals is there are formerly F-15s, but there are F-16s that act as Red Air. Well, what most people don't realize is since the early 70s, there have been other aircraft acting as Red Air at Red Flag, and those are actually Red aircraft, MiG 21s, MiG 17s, MiG 29s. David Sensati's website, the Aviationist, posted a photograph of someone filming a dogfight over the Groom Lake area with an Su-27 and an F-16. We have a lot of foreign aircraft that live in that area that are kept under wraps because we really don't want people to know what we're learning from flying an Su-27. But we also want to protect the countries and nations and air forces that have provided us said aircraft, like possibly Indonesia, where we've gotten samples. And it's probably been a ramped up situation because right now we're flying in airspaces over Syria with things like Su-30s and Su-27s. And we have to know their capabilities for not only how to fight against them, but how to fight with them and how to protect ourselves when we're engaged with them, and not necessarily against them, but you need to know how those aircraft react. So unfortunately, it probably will be a long time before Colonel Schultz's story will come out, but the man had 6 degrees, a doctorate in aeronautics, has flown with the Canadian Air Force at their test squadron, was an F-18 pilot, was qualified in the F-35, and was one of the original F-35A pilots. He shouldn't be forgotten, even though we might not ever know exactly what aircraft he was flying. But you can assure that the best of the best are flying out in Nellis, and they might not be flying F-35s and F-22s, but things like MiG-29s and Su-27s. And, of course, there are those other aircraft that lurk out there, like F-117s that still fly around, even though they're not supposed to be. But more importantly, we lost a really good pilot and a really good wealth of information. So that's really where the story should be about, is Colonel Schultz, not necessarily about what he was flying at the time.
Yeah. Wow. I had about 6 questions when we started, David, but you answered all of them along the way. But also, David, interestingly, as we record this on September 18th, that's a important anniversary date.
It is. It was September 18th, 70 years ago, as we're recording this, that the United States Army Air Forces were separated from the United States Army and became its own service, the United States Air Force. So happy 70th birthday to the USAF. While we're not been around as long as the RAF for some other countries' air forces, we still, I got to say, have the best in the world. So, and I jokingly said, and of course, if you had to pick one aircraft that represents the U.S. Air Force, you might as well pick the C-130, because over 2/3 of its lifetime as an air force, the Air Force has flown the C-130.
Hmm. Amazing, huh?
Well, I'm kind of sorry we don't have Rob around here. It'd be fun to have him reminisce about what it was like when those two services separated.
Yeah, I know.
70 years ago.
Yeah. No,
yeah, we're just kidding.
You mean when the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force were broke apart from the Royal Flying Services, you know, back 100 years ago? Is that what we were talking about?
Yeah. We like to pick on Rob. He's not that old.
No.
Oh, but it's fun to get.
Almost, but not quite. All right. We have an item from the Buffalo News. Citing costs, panel advises rolling back post-3407 air safety measure. As you'll recall, Culgan Air Flight 3407 was operating as a Continental Connection codeshare flight, and it crashed into a house in Clarence Center, New York in 2009, killing all on board and one person on the ground. The NTSB report faulted the pilots for, well, I guess you'd say, responding improperly to the stall warnings. And, of course, this led to a regulatory change, and that was that it required commercial pilots to have 1,500 hours of flight experience, which upped the game, upped the bar. Maybe not the game, upped the bar pretty significantly. In a recent report, the Aviation Rulemaking Advisory Committee said that the 1,500-hour rule, quote, imposes costs that exceed benefits. An interesting development. Max Trescott, what do you think about that? I mean, if the rule is scaled back, let's say, that would have a big impact.
Well, it certainly would. It's important to remember that this crash occurred over 8 years ago. It was the last crash of a U.S. airliner, so we've had a remarkable safety record since that time. And it's also important to remember that those pilots, I don't remember the exact number, but I believe both of them had over 2,500 hours of experience. So it was a little perhaps ironic or odd that one of the key rules that came out of that was to require first officers to have 1,500 hours of experience and an ATP, when both had far more than that. So in a sense, the new rules didn't really address the root causes of that crash, which probably had a lot more to do with pilot fatigue and possibly with training and stall recognition. So anyway, the Aviation Rulemaking Advisory Committee is a committee of the FAA. And I did a lot of digging around here. I could not find their 154-page report anywhere online.
I looked for it, too. I know. Maybe it's just not published yet. But, yeah, because I wanted to see this exactly the wording. Because, you know, sometimes the press reports don't they don't capture all of the important information, but
yeah. And so I did find another report that said that they did approve the report 14-4 with one abstention, that there were a number of recommendations that came out of it, including one regarding airline pilot qualifications. And so what they're proposing now is that apparently the pilots would still be required to have an ATP, which was the new requirement. And by the way, if you go back prior to that requirement, there were folks sitting in the right seat of airliners with, you know, as low as 300 hours sometimes. And a lot of people might go, oh my God, that's actually pretty much the standard for a lot of airlines around the world. So many airlines will pop people in the right seat with 250 hours. So the U.S. is really the exception, requiring now 1,500 hours. So apparently the report has approved allowing pilots to, once they're hired by the airlines, qualify their ATP based on some additional training given by the airlines. And I should mention, there still are some exceptions even today that were built into the original rule. If you go to certain universities, you can get credit for academic training, which will knock off hundreds of hours from that $1,500 requirement. And of course, a lot of folks say, hey, we need this because we're desperately short of pilots. Others will counter, gosh, you know, we're just desperately short of people who are willing to take a salary as low as $25,000 or $30,000 a year. Now, to be fair, those salaries have gone up a lot in the last 2 years. So in my mind, I don't have heartburn over these kinds of changes. I do feel for the folks in Buffalo, because I'm sure they feel that these rules were some kind of vindication or you know, something that said that their relatives didn't die in vain. They certainly didn't. I think a lot of positive things happened, but I'm not sure that requiring everybody to have 1,500 hours in the right seat actually makes sense.
These sorts of things are always tough because there's certainly pressure, let's say, on the regulators or on Congress to take some kind of action when you have something terrible like this happen. And the response you get doesn't always really, really address the problem. It's kind of difficult. You know, in some ways, Andrew, it's almost like a data problem. I mean, you know, what does the data show? Is there any data out there that, you know, relates hours of flying time to proficiency? Or are there other factors? I mean, I imagine it can be kind of an enormously complicated problem to look at that and use the data to, well, come to the right decision.
Well, it can be. I think, you know, it's interesting to hear, as I listen to you guys talk about this news item, as you mentioned, there's an 8-year time frame from when this was originally implemented until now. And we're seeing these days airlines like Horizon, for example, really struggling with flight cancellations, as they claim being a problem of being able to find qualified pilots to fly the aircraft to meet their obligations on the schedule.
Right.
And we're talking 8 years after this this increase in the timing. And so it strikes me as a long, long period where we probably could have seen an impact earlier if it truly was a situation that was causing the problems. But when you do talk to the airlines and you start to dig in and visit them in their operations, you do see that it is clearly in their mind and probably even in their operations a real problem. But when you look at how to address some of these, let's say post-incident ways to make corrections and move towards a better or more safe future, data is always something people are talking about these days. And in aviation, we've got decades of experience leveraging data after an incident to go back and try and figure out what happened and how we can do better. But I think there's always something to be said for having experience in the cockpit, and particularly what we've been doing so far in a lot of the work we've done with the industry has been to partner or leverage the experience that people bring and connect that to the data that we can find, bring those together either to address optimization, so finding the best way to do something, or to prioritize information coming to make sure that that experienced operator can make a decision faster and be able to make a more consistent decision in the cockpit or on the ground to better the operation, as you will, in the airline.
And that's a safer situation as well, I have to believe.
It is, yeah. And a lot of the work on data now is driving, as you mentioned, sort of in the introduction, we're seeing a lot of the push now is moving towards predictivity, or trying to find a way for us to use the data to find anomalies or issues that may require maintenance or may require some attention early enough in the process so that it doesn't cause a delay in the flight or a delay in the aircraft being available for a future flight. The term AOG for an airline is a bad word. It means aircraft on the ground. And most airlines will say an aircraft on the ground is not making them any money. And getting that thing back up in the air is their highest priority.
Yeah, I remember from my days at Pratt & Whitney, if we had a customer that had an AOG, just about everybody stopped just about everything to address that problem. And if it meant some employee buying a ticket on a plane so he could carry a spare part to the airport to resolve the problem, that's what we did, Dan. AOGs, immediate response.
No doubt. You know, I don't know what time period that was, but I could have said it was probably last week.
Yeah. Some things never change.
No, they don't.
All right. One last news item before we get into our focus conversation with Andrew. And this is kind of a goofy story. Rob sort of surfaced this and was a little unsure as to whether or not we should toss it into the show plan for this episode. Of course, that was before he knew that he wouldn't be able to make it. And I dumped it in there because, well, I wanted to see what Rob had to say, but we'll go on without him. This is a YouTube video, a very short YouTube video from a cell phone. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. It's simply titled, What in God's Name? And what we have here is a passenger, a window seat passenger, and the passenger behind her has removed her, well, whatever she had on her feet, and she has her feet propped up kind of in the space of the woman who's taking the video, who has just kind of a priceless expression on her face as she pans over and looking at these fairly well manicured toes impeding into her space. What was happening is kind of unclear from the comments in the video, under the video on YouTube. It's clear that most people were kind of grossed out by the prospect of having another passenger's feet come into their space. Maybe we should have brought this together with the earlier issue on seat space, but
yeah, exactly. We're coming full circle here.
We kind of are. Maxie, what did you think about this?
Oh, I just thought it was one of the endless number of stories out there about bad airline experiences. You know, one could devote an entire show, almost a daily show, to bad experiences that occur on airlines. So I just thought, all right, well, this is a novel one. It was kind of funny to see those feet sticking up between the where the window is and the seat. So I got to guess my reaction would have been, good time to recline that seat hard and fast.
Oh dear,
not really. Yeah. I mean, you don't want to injure the person. But
yeah, I think, there was one comment that I thought someone had the best solution. This came by way of somebody who called himself the Mossy Grave. But this person posted, here's what you do. Ask for water, dip several fingers in the water, pretend to sneeze, and flick your fingers toward the bunions. Feet gone, problem solved. I thought that was pretty creative.
Yeah, that is better than slamming the seat back. Yeah. I like that solution.
Thanks, Rob, for bringing this to our attention. Again, we're speaking with Andrew Kemmett-Miller, who is Vice President Aviation at Uptake. You can find them at uptake.com, UPTAKE. Andrew, again, welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, guys. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, maybe we can start at a simple level. The term that we hear a lot these days in many contexts is the Internet of Things. Can you define that for us? Give us a sort of a description that baselines us on what we talk about. What do we mean when we talk about the Internet of Things?
Sure, I can try. I don't know if I'm qualified to speak to the actual scope of the entire Internet of Things. It's a pretty big concept. But the Internet of Things, or IoT, as a lot of people will call it, is really an evolution of this technology that evolved into the Internet from the DARPA project back in the late 60s, early 70s, and then up to the early Internet days of the 90s, where originally the Internet was all about humans being able to use computers to do research, communicate with each other, be able to find things across the world on the World Wide Web. The Internet's now being used by devices, and these devices have computers that run autonomously from humans, so people don't necessarily have any input into this device, and it still communicates across the Internet certain items. And most of these early applications were focused around manufacturing. So you found robots in factories, for example, were collecting information and sending that back via network to be able to provide information about where there might be a problem or how fast something was being done. Recently, what we've seen over the last several years is that the size, the miniaturization of technology, and the advent of Wi-Fi and Bluetooth in mobile telephony, in computers where you have tablets now that are out there as well, and the ability to embed sensors or data collectors into devices as far-reaching as coffee makers to trash cans to the actual garbage trucks allows an organization now to start to really collect information more massively and utilize that data to forecast or to understand their operations. They might be able to find where there are certain problems, and they might be able to find where there may be problems coming. Probably one of the best applications that most folks will understand is Google Maps, for example. Being able to see traffic on your route on Google Maps is an application of IoT, where they're leveraging the sensors on everybody's phone to collect information about how fast people are moving on the road and predict how long it will take for you to drive down that road. This is kind of a futuristic part of technology, but it's not nearly as new as it perhaps was about 3 or 4 years ago. But for the aviation world, it's still something we're getting introduced to.
And yeah, how is this translating into aviation? I can imagine, as you said, in the manufacturing side of things, maybe in the maintenance side of things. But where else are we seeing this sort of creep into aviation?
Yeah, so David, you're the historian, and you'll recall that back decades ago, in response to safety, there was a very strong push by the industry to embed sensors in the aircraft and to connect those sensors on the aircraft together on something that was pre-internet, on something called a data bus, and connected to the flight recorder. And so when we talk about the black box, this is the flight recorder from those days. It's actually an orange box invented by an Australian, but we call it a black box nonetheless. So this ability for us to record sensor data and to be able to have that available to leverage for us to review or to work with has been around in our industry a long time. But in order for IoT to work, you need to also have the connectivity. And the struggle with aviation for a very long time has been the lack or the very high cost of connectivity from the aircraft. There's a technology called ACARS, which is on almost every aircraft today, which allows very simple text messaging type communication from the aircraft over a network to the ground. This is a very slow network, very, very slow network, and a very expensive network for many airlines to use. So typically not something that they can use to implement something like IoT. So there's been a push now in aviation, as you guys know, towards new connectivity and towards broadband connectivity solutions. And with that push into the market has come a resurgence or a growth in the interest of being able to use this connectivity to connect sensors and to be able to do more with the predictivity of the capture of that data.
So in effect, we're starting to piggyback on the increased bandwidth that's come about because of a pull for passenger services, in-flight connectivity, IFE, and all of that.
that's part of it. And it's probably, to be honest, most of the growth of the future in the connectivity side. But what we've also seen are that the connectivity providers in the front of the aircraft who have been providing this service for a long time have also recognized the need and have been pushing faster connectivity options to the aircraft as well. So these days, most aircraft coming off the line, new aircraft being installed, will have connectivity options available to them in the cockpit, not just the passenger side, but in the cockpit that can be up to anywhere from about 200 to 2,000 times faster than what they used to have, even as short as 4 or 5 years ago.
And so when we hear the term connected aircraft, does that just refer to sort of the limited perspective that the aircraft is connected, has the bandwidth to offer this kind of communication service? Is that what that means?
Yeah, so IoT really involves the combination of the networking, so that's what the internet really is all about, and the sensors that are embedded into the devices. So you have to have both really to work through the Internet of Things. And from an aircraft perspective, given that we've had sensors on there for decades, the new part of this equation is really the connectivity. And that's why you find that most conversations in aviation today that would be talking about IoT are really in many ways discussed as connected aircraft.
So with this capability now, I can imagine that many different interests can come to bear or can be involved in wanting to make use of this. So, you know, an engine manufacturer might be interested in engine performance data, other groups interested in others. The airline itself would have interest in, I think, certain sensors. I mean, is all of this kind of randomly occurring, or is it coordinated in some way?
Coordinate is probably a stretch of a word to say, but I would say that the industry, by and large, can be split into three main groups right now. Certainly what we call the original equipment manufacturer, the OEM. So, for example, from an aircraft perspective, an OEM example would be Airbus or Boeing or Bombardier. Someone who builds the aircraft itself is highly interested in how they can take data from the aircraft while it's flying historically over a period of time and be able to use that information to make better decisions and to be able to optimize or improve the next generation of aircraft. So what you find is that, for example, in the 787 program that Boeing launched back in the early 2000s, there was a quantum jump in the amount of data that's collected on the aircraft, to the point where now there's somewhere around a half a terabyte or about 500 gigabytes of data that can be collected on every flight. And Airbus, in many ways, on the A350 program also leapt forward a generation with collecting data on the aircraft. Much of that information collected today, the purpose is for them to be able to run better warranty support, better maintenance programs with the aircraft. But also that data helps them to improve their design, improve their efficiencies as they look to the next generation of aircraft. So we find that with the OEMs for certain. The airlines, of course, as we said earlier, from an AOG perspective, having an operation that's running on time all the time is a heavy priority for them. And getting data ahead of time that allows them to start to plan their maintenance, for example, earlier, to be able to reduce that aircraft being stuck at the gate is a tremendous advantage for them. So airlines, in a lot of ways, have become the nexus or the central point for us as we start to explore data within aviation to find where the interest lay. It's typically around an airline operation as we find it today. But then you also find a real push from the airline in the customer focus teams. So when you start to talk about what really drives an airline, and I guess this can somewhat plug back to the seat space question, is that what drives an airline in many ways is the revenue, that's obvious, but how passengers walk away from their experience. And the high yield passenger, so the business class passenger, the frequent flyer, tends to focus on two major items. One is on-time performance, and the second is frequency of flights. And if anything were to happen to cause a decrease in frequency, whether that's cancellations or delays, or for them to have some sort of irregular operation where they have to suffer in a being late for a business meeting or they can't get home on time. That is something the airlines will typically hear about from their customer. And anything they can do from a data collection perspective to keep the customer from having that experience, their operations always benefit. Hmm.
So with the availability of this much data, then that allows predictive analytics. Can you tell us a little bit about what predictive analytics involves from your perspective?
Sure. So we can start with, and I know we've got a glass cockpit specialist as well, Max. So you've kind of lived through some of the evolution as well around this. But we all should assume that the aircraft is incredibly safe and it is built to have components on the aircraft be able to fail or have a problem, and the aircraft is still very safe to fly. And so we should start with the premise that the aircraft we fly are very safe, but parts fail. I've been on planes many times where they've come on to announce that a mechanic's in the cockpit, he has to change a sensor or an alarm that has been triggered on a particular item. And so these things do happen regularly. And the expectation around predictive maintenance today is not so much to identify where a part may cause a serious problem. What it's intended to do is really to focus on keeping the operation running efficiently and smoothly. So the idea behind predictive maintenance isn't so much to identify when a part's going to fail, which is absolutely what gets done. But the idea is to identify a window you have as the operator, in this case an airline, to be able to make a change to that part when it best suits your purpose or your timing. So if you have the part and a mechanic ready to repair that part in the next airport, you may wish to change that part at the next airport rather than wait three or four airports when that part may, three or four flights, I should add, when that part may actually fail and you won't have a mechanic or the part to fix it, where you'd have to take a delay. So it's really trying to match the part, the person, and the aircraft together in the right place at the right time to reduce the amount of delays and improve the efficiency of the operation.
Hmm. So how do you actually do that? I mean, what are the folks at Uptake doing, or what tools are they applying, or what methods are they using that allows this sort of predictive capability?
Yeah, it's so you're talking to a non-engineer, so I'm going to try to explain this in layman's term because that's about how much I can understand.
No, that's great.
Yay! Yeah,
right.
If David
right.
gets it, we will have succeeded.
But in all seriousness, there's a tremendous amount of work around mathematics where we need to really run some very serious computing horsepower against a lot of data. The way this works typically is that we have to develop algorithms. These are formulas that we use that are meant to find anomalies or some sort of failure that happens in a particular instance. And our goal is to leverage our scientists. We have data scientists whose job is really to build these models, who look at the problem that we're trying to solve and the data that we have in front of us, and be able to generate a mathematical model that can say when these particular things happen, what we have seen in the past, at a certain percentage of the time, is this failure or this cascade of failures that will happen. Refining that model over time is what really gives us that predictive capability. Finding a way for our data scientists to dig into the data repeatedly and evolve or enhance this model over a number of different iterations to make it ideal. So it's really interesting for me, coming from a flight background, a flight operations background, and really sort of being a guy who worked with a paper and pencil a lot of his career, and then coming over here to Uptake, what I found was just how important it was to match up this veteran experienced mechanic or pilot who has a gut feeling about how this engine has worked, for example, for the last 20 years, with this really smart and intelligent data scientist who focuses on mathematical models, and putting these two together so that we can leverage the experience this engineer has with the data scientist being able to build the models. And it's really really, truly about taking this veteran experience and putting it into computing. We can evaluate as people the problems very well, but we can't evaluate the number of potential options or issues that may be out there very well. We need to focus on one or 20 at a time. A computer or data science is very good at looking at thousands or millions of particular issues or data fields at a time and highlighting those that need to be looked at. So we find a lot of efficiency or prioritization opportunities through data science that give us great predictivity.
Hmm. Max, can I ask a follow-on question?
Of course, David.
How do you validate that data? In my career as a marketer, I'm stuck with the data that's provided to me by our IT or our operations team, and I sometimes question that data. How do you go about validating? I mean, you're using gut instinct, which I would rely over a computer any day, but how do you validate what, given the amount of data you're dealing with?
So the more historical data we have to analyze in the beginning of our work on a particular problem, the better we get at launching the solution. So you're spot on in the sense that we really need to look at the historical data to see what true colors we can pull out of this and be able to push forward in a prediction model. So we have a simulation capability that we can go back to the historical data, run it through this mathematical model, and be able to see what we would have found if we had run it through this model, say 300 days ago. And then we evaluate that against what we saw operationally within the organization. So we go back and we look at maintenance logs, or we look at what the engineers found, and we can compare our results in the simulation with what the engineers found in real life. And as we start to do that evaluation, we can improve or teach our data science, our mathematical models, to get better and better and better. So we have what we call a feedback loop. It's not Uptake's trademark to say feedback loop, but we use that term a lot when we work with our customers and our operators. We like to know how we're doing. So part of the value of how we make this work is that when we present this and say, we think this is a potential maintenance repair you want to make, it's really important for us to hear back from that engineer. What did you do? Did you actually make the repair? Was it what we thought it was, or was it something different? And we have what we call a machine learning capability within our system that allows that feedback. So when the engineer sends back the feedback and says, yes, it was, he's actually teaching our computer, our mathematical model, that it was correct, and it will continue to learn over time.
Cool.
Yeah, that is fascinating. Yeah, I've been involved.
I actually understood that.
Good.
Wow.
Andrew's good. Yeah. And over the years, I've been involved in many instances of, you know, what we would call simulation. Going back and assessing a model based on a comparison of what it would have predicted and what did happen is something that you almost never see. And of course, without that, you're just left guessing as to the accuracy of the model. So I think what you're doing at Uptake, it makes a lot of sense to me. Let's look at it from the standpoint of, let's say, the passenger. What does this kind of predictive analytics do for the passenger? How does it impact the passenger?
There are two different ways that data analytics, and when we talk about data science, sometimes the term data analytics will also be used, even though they're slightly different, but data analytics is also a term that's used frequently. Data analytics can be used in two very different ways within an airline. One is where we sit, which is in the operational side, and that's really the Internet of Things is really focused more on operations and the industrial part of an organization. The other place where data analytics can take place is in yield management or in revenue management. And so we find a lot of airlines today spending a lot of time on the revenue management side. So where can a customer find some of this happening? Well, frequent flyer is one place we find a lot of data analytics projects where, you know, everybody gets a an invitation to join a credit card, and the amount of frequent flyer miles you get offered can depend on how often you've flown the airline, what routes you've flown, a whole bunch of different factors. They make that dependent really on your profile and not on something that's just common anymore. They've made it much more custom. In our world, where we look at the operation side, where the customer gets the most benefit is really around two main areas. One is the fact that the efficient operation of an airline, which is what our responsibility really is in offering our services to the industry, is something that will mean the customer's going to see less delays, going to see better pushback times, better flight schedules, because the block times, which are the schedule times from takeoff to landing, should also reduce based on the ability to be more efficient. But the one that I'm most probably excited about, that I think is the most interesting problem for us to tackle as an industry, is irregular operations. And so these are when we see a thunderstorm in O'Hare, or an ice storm in Dallas, or some sort of event which creates havoc in our air traffic control system and in our
hurricane over Miami.
I wasn't going to go there, but that's definitely an appropriately close example of what we've seen.
How about a blizzard in New York or Philadelphia? We'll go that route.
There we go. So weather's always a problem. The good news about weather is it's typically a little bit able to be forecast in advance. A hurricane, certainly, you can plan for a lot of things. A snowstorm is a little bit closer in. You'll know a few hours ahead of time that there's a storm coming in. But the complexity of an airline operation means you have to interweave crew scheduling. You have to interweave cargo planning, catering, fueling, maintenance, ground support. Aircraft have to be transferred to different flights and made sure that there's an appropriate amount of time left for the crew to be able to fly the next flight. There's a lot of complexity in the system. And so when you get a weather event like a blizzard in Philadelphia, it really throws a lot of problems into the system. And that cascades. It's like a pebble dropped in the water, and the ripples just spread out and out and out. And it's not just located with a legacy airline or a hub airline that may be based in Philadelphia, but point-to-point airlines suffer as well, as you start to see some cascade effects in air traffic control and in some of the ground support services with fuel and so forth. So it really becomes a general problem for the industry. And so as we start to dig into the operational efficiency and we look at how something like a blizzard in Philadelphia can be changed by the use of data and the impact of something like data analytics or data science on the operations, you can really make things happen.
This is fascinating. Andrew, are your clients strictly U.S.-based, or do you have international clients?
No, we're definitely a global operation, and we're not just aviation-focused.
Yes, right.
A couple of benefits that we have particularly are our ability to really leverage a lot of the data science that we've done from one industry to the next, and I can give you an example of that. So we do some work in mining, for example. Mining, you've probably seen those big trucks. They look like those big yellow trucks we all had as kids driving around in our sandboxes, except these are about 50 feet tall.
Right, the enormous ones.
Yeah, the enormous ones. And these are very expensive trucks. Very hard to maintain, but they have enormous tires on them, and those tires are very expensive and come with a lot of sensors on them, so you can track pneumatically what their pressure is and temperature and all sorts of different things. Not altogether different than what we see on a 747 or an A380, where you have these large, expensive tires that are on the aircraft, and they are very sensor-driven. There's a number of sensors on a tire. Tire blowouts are a problem in the mining industry. If that big truck has a flat tire, it's a problem. And unfortunately, from a data science perspective, there are not enough of these events for us to be able to go back historically and catch a lot of anomaly data or problem data over time. However, as we start to look across not just mining, but a number of different industries we're in, where we see tires, for example, but pneumatic assets like tires that have these sensors that have similar problems with heat or puncturing or some sort of tire pressure, for example, problems, we're able to bring all of that data together and create a better model that will work to predict potential failures, not only for the mining truck, but for example, for an aircraft, where you'll have a tire that may not regularly experience a tire blowing out. And so you really need to struggle to find a way to create a predictive model for that, just looking at the aircraft tire. By going across the industries, you now can create a better model. That's a great opportunity for us in that area.
Now, could you extend those kinds of things to other? I'm thinking of the, you know, the big caterpillars on shows like Gold Rush. You know, the miners up in Alaska. It seems like every week something is breaking down on that show. You know, the D10 dozer seems to break down every other week.
Oh, it does. Each industry has its unique problems, and the benefit of working here over the last year is that I've been in aviation, as I said, for a long time. You sort of get a little bit isolated and cloistered, if you will, and focus a lot on what aviation problems there are. The last year has been eye-opening for me as I've been able to work and partner with, you know, peers on our team that are engaged in all sorts of really amazing projects in Australia, Canada, mining trucks, bulldozers, you name it. It's phenomenal.
All right. Well, Andrew, we should tell our listeners where they can learn more about Uptake. We mentioned the website, uptake.com, but Uptake's also active in social media.
We are. Probably the best place for us to be contacted is through uptake.com. We do have a form that you can fill out on there if you'd like more information on us for aviation. I can promise you that filling out that form will get information over to our team. We'd be able to reach out to you. That's probably the best way to reach us. We are on Twitter and LinkedIn and some other social media sites as well. The best way to find us is to just search for Uptake.
Great. And we'll put links to the social media places where Uptake can be found in the show notes. So you can, as you say, Andrew, people can just search for it or just go to the show notes and we'll have those links right there. Andrew, thank you very much. Really fascinating conversation. We like to explore different little nooks and crannies of aviation. Maybe this one isn't such a small little nook or cranny, but it definitely sounds like something that's got sort of immediate near-term value. What's the task look like into the future? If you polish up your crystal ball, what do you see coming along for Uptake in the future?
Well, so for us, there are two primary focuses as an organization that I think we bring value-wise out to aviation, and this is where we're focusing our time and attention. One is clearly focused around the idea of predictive maintenance and helping airlines and the operators in the supply chain really be able to make that aircraft and the entire operation, frankly, more maintenance-friendly and effective with minimal AOG is what I think a lot of airlines like to hear. But I think really, as I said earlier, bringing value of making a more efficient use of the aircraft also promotes efficient use of the airspace, efficient use of the crew, and brings better value to those passengers who are flying on those aircrafts. We really would like to see an opportunity for the industry to do better.
Well, and there's one final thing we should ask, which is we'd like to figure out how to apply data analytics to podcasts. So could you help us predict, you know, which hosts are not going to be available when we record each week?
Yeah.
Well, we've already been able to forecast that there will be at least one Max on number 471. So we're definitely good, there.
Good use of data.
All right.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Andrew.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys.
All right, what's up with the geeks? Let's see. David, you've got an adventure coming. I'm jealous, David, or envious maybe, of what you've got coming up in the near future.
Well, next week, Tuesday the 26th through October 1st, I'm going to visit family. My brother, of course, most people know, lives in Toronto. But while I'm there, there happens to be the big drone conference, which is going to be occurring on the 27th and the 28th, where I will be covering it for that other podcast. And maybe I'll throw some stuff this way also. But I'm looking forward to it. But a shout out to all of our listeners up in Toronto. Anybody around, let me know, and maybe we can hook up and have a beer or something. But again, I'm going up for the conference. So I will be downtown Toronto on the 27th, 28th, and then the 29th through the 1st. I don't know where I'll be, either downtown Toronto or up at Lake Simcoe, vegging out with my family, which will be a nice event, nice time.
All right, very good. And Max Trescott, what have you got going on these days?
Well, I just almost completed training a Cirrus owner who is working under the new Embark program. I don't know if we talked about this, but a couple of months ago, Cirrus came out with a program where they are offering free training for buyers of used aircraft so that people get 3 days of training. And I think that's just because they're trying to make everyone in their aircraft safer, not just people who buy new airplanes and therefore get training bundled in with that at the factory, but anybody who buys a used aircraft. So was spent all day Thursday as part of a 3 day is a free training that this local owner has gotten. So I would just say anybody who's thinking about buying a used Cirrus, make sure you check out the Embark program because that'll save you some bucks and also make sure that you get you know, the best possible training in your new airplane.
All right, great.
That's that new to you airplane, right?
Yes, I realized when I said new airplane, it's like new used.
Well, no, they used to say with reruns back in the day. Now we don't ever have those anymore. You know, it will be new to you if you haven't seen it before.
Yeah, exactly. This would be if you buy a pre-owned aircraft, not a used aircraft.
All right, we've got a listener recording that we received, and this is about the AvGeek Day in Ecuador. And so Andrea is going to describe that, and let's give her a listen.
Hello, everyone. Welcome over to the AvGeek Day from Ecuador. I am Andrea Larenas, president and founder of AvGeek official organization and AvGeek Day's co-founder. It is a truly pleasure for me to be here and be able to share our stories with you. But first, I need to thank Isaac Alexander, a wonderful person that made this happen. I'm really excited to tell you how the idea of AvGeek Day was born, what happened with our first edition, and how was our second edition this last August. So, let's begin. At 2012, we were with Aviation Guayaquil, a network that shared local and global aviation news. At that time, the spotting in Ecuador was very scarce and not many practices. As internet was growing, so the accounts then shared the spotted words in the country. So we thought, in creating an event that allowed to practice the spotting, but we know that the aviation world needs to be recognized in a place, but all the parts and compose it. Thus wanting to extend the event not only to spotters, but also to future aviation professionals, experts, and passionate about this wonderful work. And that is how the idea of AvGeek Day was born. We decided to start our first edition at October 22nd at Mariscal Antonio José de Sucre Airport in Quito, our capital. Through descriptions, were granted the 13 exclusive seats to enter the event. We visited the control tower. The supervisor solved all doubts about air traffic controllers' work. We took as many pictures as we could and as you can imagine, and then we visited LATAM Airlines Hangar, where all the assistants were able to know the facilities, ask questions, and go through their Airbus 319. Our first event was a success, so we decided to start in Guayaquil this year at the José Joaquín de Olmedo Airport, then come with a construction of approximately 60,000 square meters, and LATAM Airlines Ecuador were again our co-organizer, and Sky Ecuador Aviation School were our official sponsor. Thanks to the trust of Taxan, the airport operator, we were able to grant 50 exclusive seats, and we made it through trivia competitions, inscriptions, and drawings. If you are asking if we charge some money for the tickets, no, we don't. Because the idea is that you prove your passion for aviation through your pictures, resolving trivias, and participate in a network. So we don't charge a penny. Okay, now the good part starts. August 26th, AfGeek Day began with a special surprise to the guests. At the minute they passed filters, we took them to the amazing David Bisbal, Air Europa Airbus 313, that was ready to receive them, and they didn't have any idea. Everyone had the opportunity to sit in the cockpit, take their respective selfies, and travel to the plane from end to end. You can imagine how surprised were all of them. After that, we continue with the formal inauguration in the facilities of the Sky Ecuador, where we were received with a walkway of Cessna's Piper helicopters and fire trucks. Around noon, after our many pictures and selfies, we headed to the control tower, where they're explaining the security protocol, and we went up in groups to the sixth floor, where we waited for the supervisor in charge to explain the work they do. All of them were able to photograph, capturing the arrival and departures of flights. And guess what? They were so lucky that they can catch David Bisbal again. And the end of the tour, we moved to the Aeronautical Firefighters Station, who made their presentation with a simulation, surprising everyone with the speed of their reaction, synchrony, and efficiency of their work. These guys were so amazing that many people believe there was an emergency in the airport. But well, it was just a simulation. After a lunch between airplanes, we headed to the Alfa Cerrado, a section of the disabled track that allows to observe the passage of older airplanes and provides a unique view for spotting. We enjoyed for 2 hours, and with the arrival of KLM, we ended the photo shoot and gave away to the final surprise. LATAM prepared its Boeing 767 to receive us, explain its operation, and give everyone the opportunity to know their aircraft. We end the AfGeek Day with a total of 12 hours, sharing, enjoying, and making known our passion for aviation. I hope that you enjoy our story, and for knowing more about our common events, you can visit our networks. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter as AfGeek Official, and our website is www.afgeekofficial.com. Right now it is in Spanish, but soon we'll have in English too. Thank you for your time, and good winds.
Oh, thanks, Andrea. That's what an amazing event. I just love it that she and a number of other folks have been able to put together something as exciting as this for a collection of AvGeeks. Just wonderful. And shout out to Isaac for the assist in this as well.
Yep, I think that's what it takes. You get a few enthusiastic people with a good idea, and people just kind of rally around and help make it come true. So, yeah, I think that's pretty cool. And just a quick shout out to Ecuador. I visited there when I was in high school with a group many, many, many years ago. Oh. So it was fun to get down that part of the world.
Wow. And again, the website is www.avgeekofficial.com. When I checked it, yeah, it wasn't available in English yet, but Google did a really nice job of translating it, and so it's still usable. All right, we also received a recording from Austin. Now, he's an Army aviator in Afghanistan, and he talks about, well, several things, including his experience flying in combat. So here's Austin.
Hello, fellow geeks. This is Austin reporting from my compartment of a living space that I call my home until I complete my year-long deployment to Afghanistan. I was just listening and enjoying episode 467 when a topic arose that I'm living firsthand. I figured I'd leave some audio and send it in. But the topic of discussion during the podcast was concerning the shortage of military pilots due to our strained deployment cycles and the quality of life. And it seems like majority of the focus is on the Air Force whenever there is talk regarding pilot shortages of the military. But my perspective is that of the life of an Army pilot. The struggles among the other branches to retain pilots can be echoed just so much as, you know, as much in those branches as it is in the Army. We have a systemic issue across all the branches. My brethren and the Navy and the Air Force and even the Marines, we're all feeling this systemic issue. But I wanted to highlight that As an Army aviator, we're faced with extraordinary stresses as well regarding these deployment cycles and quality of life. We don't have a pilot retention rate issue. As much as the other branches, I believe the Air Force actually has the highest retention rate amongst all the branches. So they're actually able to keep their pilots a little bit longer. But we're deploying our aviators for anywhere between 9 to 12 months at a time. And in my community of Army aviation, we're told to expect to be home for about a year, sometimes less, considering all the training that we go to once we do come home that we're not able to do when we're abroad in different theaters or regions of the world. So sometimes you don't get that year before you're packing your bags, kissing your families goodbye, and you're going on another deployment. So it's a pretty high turnover rate. It's like a revolving door, they say. But the high level of deployment rates are burning out the masses of pilots. In the month of August, I could tell you I flew 26 of 31 days here, and several days included multiple sorties. So there's times where I landed and I said, hey, put so much fuel in the plane, and I'll be right back after I go grab a bite. I'm going right back up. So the tempo of the fight in the region of this region, specifically the world, it's pretty demanding and fast, and it requires a high level of motivation and focus. But I want to note the flying environment here as well in Afghanistan for all pilots, rotor, even the remote pilot aircraft, the fighter guys, the transport guys, it's extraordinary, and it's very challenging. I've never experienced such a challenging place in my lifetime of aviation. It's been so much of a trial. A lot of the terrain here, it dwarfs the Rockies. Some places you see that it's pretty relentless and unforgiving. So it really makes you think twice about your aircraft performance, your figures, and your survival in case you have to go down. Most of the terrain here is not even remotely close to sea level. Some terrain is up towards 20,000 feet. And depending on what part of the country you're flying in, depending on your altitude, you could see K2 and you could see Everest, as a matter of fact, from certain parts of this country. So I thought that was kind of interesting to share. But our equipment here, and just in general, it seems to be aging. Our aviators are moving on to different careers, and time and resources devoted to the 16-year-long war are exhausting on our great nation. And I just ask for everyone to continue their support of everybody here. So I figured I'd share that. Before I go, I would like to share my first experience from flying in combat. My co-pilot is a friend of mine for some years now, and I were returning from a mission and began what I would learn would be become normal practice of reducing the power of the aircraft to idle. And then we'd pitch the nose down and begin about a 5,500 foot per minute descent into the approach area. And you would sustain that from flight level all the way down to short final. And then you would slow it down to something like a normal descent rate, so you can kind of normalize things before you put the airplane down onto the ground safely. But all the lights are off inside and out for tactical reasons and in the aircraft. And you're within the airplane's limits the whole time. But let me tell you, it's like you're screaming towards the earth. It's a very unnatural feeling. It's loud, and the amount of air going over the cockpit is extraordinary. The air traffic control advised us a number of heading changes while we were making our way through 10,000 feet. And it was at that moment, or a little bit shortly after that, we began preparing to slow the plane down for landing, that the aircraft on final in front of us reported taking surface to air fire. And I looked at my friend and my co-pilot, he's a buddy of mine, to kind of gauge his reaction to hearing that on the radio, like, hey, the guy in front of us is getting shot at. And I didn't know whether I should be concerned or not. Of course, he's the last person I should be looking at because he's a former Apache guy. As a matter of fact, he would start smiling at a situation like that. And he smiled and he looked at me and said, hey, maybe you can get your combat action badge today. We won't have to wait. And I just didn't know what to think of that. So we just continued on the approach, and air traffic control then instructed us, call 3 miles with the gear, and you're number two. You're following another fixed-wing aircraft, and they are reported to be taking ground fire. And it was then I realized, man, this is just my first mission. This is going to be this may be a long year. So anyways, I wanted to share with the audience and with the podcast crew my perspective on the pilot shortage, and share a little tidbit about my first mission in combat here. And I just ask everybody to keep thinking about us, and I'm looking forward to getting back to the United States next year. And I hope everyone is doing well.
Well, thank you, Austin. Well, thank you for your service. Thank you for being a listener, and thank you for sending along that recording. Fascinating observations.
He's too modest. Because of this show, I am friends with Austin. When I met Austin, he was an enlisted personnel with the United States Army Golden Knights parachute team. He worked on the Fokker the C-27s. He then was chosen for officer candidate school to learn to fly helos and fixed wings, and now flies what they call guardrail aircraft, which for most people who don't realize, it's a twin beach, packed with electronic sensors for the Army. He's done a tour in Korea, and now he's doing a tour in Afghanistan, and both tours away from his family. I think about him daily. He's one of people I regard highly, and I'm sure that there are much more stories that he'd love to share, but what he does for a living, he really can't talk about. But I always think about him.
Wow. I didn't realize that you knew Austin. So again, thanks so much. And we'll all be thinking of you, Austin, and all the other folks who are serving their country.
Yeah, and that sounds pretty scary to be coming down at 5,500 feet per minute, lights off. I mean, he did a great job of kind of describing what it would be like to be in the aircraft doing that. And I can say that I think that's true for just about every pilot, but even more so for the kinds of things that he's doing. You know, we just can't afford to be thinking about other things because, boy, flying demands our best.
Yes. All right. Some listener mail. We had a couple of exchanges. Actually, it started out being an email from a listener, and everybody, all the co-hosts got involved in a couple of interesting conversations. One was sparked by Mac, who sent us a photo. This is a picture of Air Force One, and there's President Trump. You can see him over the wing waving. But the interesting part, well, maybe that's the interesting part too, but the most interesting part is the shot of the pylon on Air Force One here, which shows some kind of an attachment that is, it's sort of an odd-looking thing. And the question was, what the heck is that? David, you understood what this was. Maybe you can give us sort of the brief description.
And then I want an answer from our co-host about a comment he made. What it is a anti-infrared heat-seeking missile and radar-guided missile defense system. Our co-host Rob got into a discussion, well, it's chafe. It's not. While chafe is and window, if you go back to World War II, is little strips of metal that you pop so that it blinds the radar-guided missile or blinds the radar. Likewise, if you pop flares, that's for heat-seeking missiles. This kind of defense system does both. It basically blinds both systems by sending large amounts of precision radiation back towards the airplane. It affects both the radar-guided missiles as well as the heat-seeking missiles. The way I described it to my co-host Rob was, what it does to both missiles is it's like shaking a high-powered flashlight and staring at and shining it right into your eyes. You get completely blinded and you can't track the aircraft, because when this is implemented, the aircraft, I'm sure, is yanking and banking and jinxing. However, my co-host, Mr. Trescott, provided the the actual designation of the system, because I was trying to keep it simple, and then said it was available on the Cirrus. My problem with that is I wasn't sure if he was joking or he was serious.
Well, we've got to read the quote here. I said, looks like your standard AN/ALQ-204 Matador infrared countermeasure, quotes, IRCM, unquote, system. And then I just said, got him on the Cirrus, too. Well, of course, I know that because of my intimate knowledge of... No, I'm kidding. I had to look that up on the internet. I was intrigued to find that Air Force One is equipped with five of these, one on each engine pylon and one on the rear of the aircraft as well. And some of the Cirrus are equipped with some interesting, gear for surveillance and things like that. But no, none with countermeasures that I'm aware of.
Okay, I was just sort of, if you noticed when in the email exchanges, I just sort of left that one alone. I was like, okay, I think he's joking, but you know what? I don't know. So,
I thought you knew me well enough to know I was joking.
Well, I did. That's why I didn't say anything. But I'm thinking to myself, okay, why would a Cirrus need an infrared? And then I started thinking about things. Does a Cirrus generate enough heat for an AIM-9X to be able to track it? Or does it have the big enough radar cross-section for an ARAM? Because one of the things that we used to do was when I was a kid was we would play these games that were dice role-playing dogfight games, and you could do just about everything. And one of my all-time favorite dogfights was my Fokker DR1 triplane against my friend flying an F-14 Tomcat.
It doesn't sound like a fair contest.
Well, he won the first bout. Not because he got a lock on me, but because he flew over so fast it ripped the wing, ripped the fabric off of my airplane. The second time, I shot him down by a lucky gunshot because he couldn't get a lock. The DR1 didn't have enough heat signature for an AIM-9, didn't have a radar cross section because it's basically fabric for all intents and purposes. So you couldn't have a Phoenix or a Sparrow. And he couldn't really slow down enough to get me in firing range. You know, the old pop the speed brakes and they'll fly right by.
Yep.
So two out of three, I beat him with the Fokker DR1. The other one was a power dive that I was able to torque out of. He followed me and he had a collision with the ground. So the Fokker DR1 took two out of three. So with that in mind, having a Cirrus with an infrared system wasn't really too far off for some reason.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the speed difference. And I'm sure, by the way, your turn radius was probably one heck of a lot better than his,
too. Well, basically I could turn on a dime in a DR1 because that's just all torque.
And what I've often thought, and I probably wouldn't really do this, was if I were ever intercepted by, your friendly F-15 or whatever, it would be fun to start doing slow flight, 40, 50 knots. I'm sure that would really tick them off because for sure you could get the just about any GA aircraft slower than just about any other intercepting aircraft.
Okay, so we'll give a shout out to all of those CAP guys out there who act as targets for intercepts. What speed do you let the F-15s, F-16s intercept you at? Send us an email, guys, like Rod and all of the other gang out there flying for CAP and pretending they're bad guys.
I'm not sure they let themselves get intercepted. They're going to get intercepted.
But
you're right. For training purposes, they must have a target speed for sure.
Thanks, Max. That was 2 or 3 days worth of conversations.
No, I know. Sometimes these things generate so much so much effort. We can make a whole show out of some of the email exchanges. Another one was Mark Newton got us going as well. He felt compelled to comment after listening to our episode with Richard Abalafia. Mark says, I want to know what problem is supposed to be solved by pilotless airliners. He says, let's do round figures. Mark calculates on any given day, a pilot flies 3 sectors, carrying about 200 passengers each. That's 3,000 seats per week, or about 150,000 seats per annum. The pilot is typically earning less than $100,000 per annum, so the pilot's wage accounts for less than $1 a ticket. He says, given the liability and regulatory issues, why is there a perception that airlines or airframers would be prepared to invest the massive R&D, legal, and insurance costs necessary to make pilotless airliners happen just so they can save $200 a flight? So Mark says, even if airlines are saying they have a pilot shortage and they want pilotless planes to fix the mess, an easier and quicker way of doing the same thing would be to bump ticket prices up by about 60 cents per ticket and double pilot salaries. Do you think that'd get people interested in an aviation career? And then international currency fluctuations and fuel price volatility make a bigger difference to the bottom line of an airline than pilot salaries. I just don't see the business case to justify making the pilots go away. Where is it coming from? It looks like a nothing burger to me. So I don't know. There's no resolution to this. Well, we had talked about this study that UBS had done, and there's an article in a recent Aviation Week, which we can't give you a link to because they have a paywall, unfortunately. But they look at this UBS study, and UBS concludes that the numbers do work out. Now, get this. They say they see a potential profit opportunity worth about $35 billion for the aviation and aerospace manufacturing sectors. That includes more than, and I'm reading from this Avweek article, more than $26 billion in pilot-related cost savings for airlines that UBS covers, up to $3 billion in similar savings for the business jet industry, $2.1 billion for civil helicopters, flight optimization savings of more than $1 billion, or 1% of carriers' $133 billion fuel bill globally in 2016, more than $3 billion per year in savings from lower insurance premiums, i.e. safer flights. That's an interesting one. And pilot training costs. And then finally, potential revenue increases from increased utilization rates, both cargo and commercial. So I guess it depends on who's doing the figuring as to what the economics are for pilotless airliners. But the study is interesting. Not surprisingly, younger people are more accepting of the notion of pilotless airliners than older people. Some other results. Apparently, Americans are more likely to say that they'll consider flying in a pilotless airliner than those in some European countries. So interesting, but I don't know what the answer is. Sometimes I think this automation and pilotless this and autonomous that is just spurred by people's fascination with the notion more than anything else. But I guess UBS takes a different tack.
Well, so there's one group that's really strongly in favor of this that didn't get mentioned. I mean, this group would really love to see pilots eliminated altogether.
Yeah.
Yeah, flight attendants.
Yeah. Ba-doom.
By the way, I thought Rob had one of the best comments in the email chain that came out of this email from Mark Newton. He said, any idea how much grief the airlines figure they won't need to put up with from pilots and ALPA? Having been one of those rowdies myself, I bet that's in some of those decisions there, too.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty clever.
Good, Rob. All right. And then Patrick got us all cranked up on another one. What creates lift? Patrick says, I've long pointed to Bernoulli's principle, having learned that in ground school in the 60s, but I think I heard y'all, possibly David, giving another explanation. And he came across a video on YouTube. This features Professor Mike Merrifield. It's called Lift and Wings. And I think he's a physics professor or something like that. And we'll have a link to this in the show notes. You can take a look at this at your leisure. But basically, he says, yeah, that usual Bernoulli principle description of lift over an airfoil. Yeah, well, it sort of covers it, but it actually doesn't explain it all. And that there are other things that you really need to bring into the conversation to fully describe what causes lift. That being, you have to look at conservation of mass, conservation of momentum, and conservation of energy. And then there are also some viscosity effects to, thrown in there as well. So it's a really complicated, I think, set of physics going on that creates lift with an airfoil. So I don't know. I've always thought the Bernoulli explanation was sort of lacking myself. So I was happy to see somebody say that, yeah, well, but that's not the whole story.
No, I think physicists sometimes get buried too deeply down into the weeds and they need to get back up to the 30,000-foot view. I mean, it's nice to talk about Bernoulli and all these other things, conservation of energy and so on. But the bottom line is what causes lift is money. You don't have any money, you're not going to have any lift.
All right. Thanks, Max.
But what happens if you have an Uber?
Then you don't need lift.
Credit card.
You need a credit card.
Cute.
All right. Very good, guys. One last item. I think we might be running a little bit long. Ron wrote us, and maybe we'll just point this out, put the link in the show notes. He says, I think we've all been talking about ATC privatization and our actions needed to stop its implementation as outlined in H.R. 2997. Rod says, the article from Bloomberg that he gives us a link to has some good talking points pulled from a GAO study that ATC service is steadily improving and upgrading, which contradicts many of the talking points that proponents are using. I'll take the GAO study over hypothesis any day. And that's from Ron. The Bloomberg article is Trump's dire air traffic claim contradicted by government report. And the GAO, of course, is the Government Accountability Office. And they say that the FAA is on schedule to at least accomplish its basic goals by 2025, expects to do so within cost estimates from a decade ago. The system is projected to cost the government $20.6 billion, including at least $5.8 billion that's already been spent. Airlines and other aircraft owners will have to spend $15.1 billion to add new equipment to planes, that according to the GAO. They do note, though, that one of the chief issues that the FAA has encountered is a steady funding stream or lack thereof, I guess, according to the report. And that is a separate, an additional issue. I don't know if privatization would solve that or not, but I think the government could solve the steady stream of funding if it wanted to, but hasn't been able to in the past. So we'll put a link to that article in the show notes. All right, I think we need to wrap this one up. Very interesting episode, I think. Our guest, Andrew Kemmett-Miller, Vice President Aviation at Uptake, had some really fascinating things to tell us about, and maybe we'll get him on again in the future and kind of explore some other aspects of this as well. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. The show notes for this episode, well, they're at airplanegeeks.com/470. On our website, you'll find all the links to how you can contact us, how you can find us on social media, all of that. David Vanderhoof, where do people find you online?
Online, you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. On Instagram at What Just Flew By, on LinkedIn, if you can spell Vanderhoof, and of course on Fridays with that guy, Max Flight, on the UAV Digest.
Great. And Max Trescott, where do we find you?
You know, I never mentioned I had a Vanderhoof who sat behind me in sixth grade, so David, I'll have to compare notes later. It wasn't you. Let's see.
No, it wasn't, because I don't remember sitting in one-room schoolhouses.
Hey, it wasn't that long ago.
Anyway. I'm defending Rob. God help me. I'm trying to get the old age jokes in as much as I can.
Hey, it was in Pennsylvania, though, so we might have been in the same classroom there. Let's see. AviationNewsTalk.com. Click on Contact, probably the easiest way to find me. And I just want to mention we did three shows last week, all related to Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. So all interviews one with Operation Airdrop, one with Remote Air Medical, both of whom are doing relief work, and then one with Venin, who was one of the team leaders for the evacuation flight of 63 aircraft leaving Embry-Riddle last week to get out ahead of the hurricane. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight, on LinkedIn. I get a lot of requests from folks on LinkedIn. If you don't have an obvious aviation background or interest, you know, in your bio in LinkedIn, just mention it when you send me the request, because I get some of that. I can't figure out why these people would ever want to connect with me on LinkedIn. Also at the UAVDigest.com, like David said, here's a little secret. If you can't remember the UAVDigest.com, you can just go to dronepodcast.com. It'll take you right there. And also with Mary Kirby on the PaxX podcast. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Our outro by Bruno Massone, and you can find more of his great stuff at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Bye, everybody.
And thanks for listening.
Oh, Rob was here. I'll be darned.
That was a great Rob.
I've been practicing.
It shows. That's you know, I almost thought Rob snuck in on Skype somehow.
We used big data and created virtual Rob.
Virtual Rob.
Oh, but we forgot virtual Brian.
Well, that'll just be the sound of a tiger eating lunch.